We're going to do a little outline of what we are supposed to have done already to remind ourselves of certain propositions. And then when we've done that, if we've got time, we'll talk about an orientation of it for the future. Now, in general, we have been talking about what it means to exist, what it means to be a being, and what it means not to exist. Well, I've done a diagram here, and we'll have a quick peep at it, and because of the heat of this machine, we'll take it off again very quickly. When you look at this diagram, it's a circle. I marked it in, I-N, with a T around the periphery, and outside it, R-U. So if you were to read that word, it would be out. Now in English we spell it O-U-T, but we don't pronounce it O-U-T usually, we pronounce it R-U-T, out. And out, which you see in the word auto, self, is a very important word for us to consider. So if you just put that in your mind, and I'll switch off and we'll reduce the heat, at least in my area. And we'll talk about it with that diagram in mind. In the world today, we find two movements which have always been present, but they're now particularly tense in their opposition. One is a movement towards total individual self-determination, coupled with the disbelief that there is any intelligence outside the individual human being. We could call that an atheistic view. And the other is the view that there is an infinite intelligence, and that intelligence has actually precipitated the universe and all the individuals in it. Now we will see that the first position, the position of an individual insisting on his individuality as the only mark and resting place of intelligence, is deficient because it disallows the infinite. Whereas the infinite does not disallow the finite. And if we have two kinds of beings, one of which allows the existence of the other, and one which does not allow the existence of the other, the one with the larger allowance is a superior idea. Now, if we were to take as symbols the letters of the alphabet, we could start with the letter A. The English A is already a diphthong. It is pronounced in phonetic terms as if it were written with an E and an I, where the letter E is A, and the letter I is E. We pointed out before that in English you have a lot of funny diphthongs, which are the mark of English ambiguity in speech and meaning. This letter A in English, reduced to its phonic value, its sound value, says life individuates, A-E, written E-I. Remember, we are called perfidious Albion on the continent because of this capacity for saying one thing and meaning another. Or when there is a pact between two nations, one of which is the English, and the other, someone else, it is always the English version which is considered to be definitive by the English. When we look at the letter A and recognize that it's a diphthong in English, phonically, that's in sound terms, and then we look at the equivalent in other languages of the same symbol, which looks like a form of a vectored V with a bar across it, they don't say A there, they say R. And that R is nearer to the original because it represents the sound of the breathing of a child or an animal. When an animal on a hot day like today, like a dog, is panting, it is saying, it is saying that primordial sound, that R sound. And the baby's sound when it cries also is based on that. It is made with the tongue flat in your mouth in its natural relaxed position. And it was used by the ancients to symbolize the infinite power, because the breath is related to the life, because if you are disallowed to breathe, you will die. So when you make that sound, unvoiced breath, with the tongue flat at rest in the mouth, you are saying, what you're doing is feeling yourself pushing air, and the air is moving in and out of your mouth, and the same air supplies you with the oxygen which is essential to life and gets rid of another gas which is inimical to life in the same act. Now this letter A, English, R in other languages, is used to symbolize the absolute, so that the word absolute is spelt with this same letter, because that is the primary root of the word, the absolute. Now, in all philosophy, the object is to find an absolute, to find something that will stand forever, that will stand eternally, that will be a value absolutely. And the symbol of that is that letter A, which you can represent quite simply as a triangle, and if you like to put a couple of legs at the bottom to stand it on, then you will have the letter A as we write it in the capital form. And this letter is the symbol of absoluteness. It is the symbol of infinity, because when we pronounce that sound, it goes in and out of the mouth without restraint, as opposed to the situation when we start to pronounce it and then close the sound by shutting the mouth, as in saying The M cuts short the movement. Now, in all our present awareness of religious and philosophical and scientific debate, we find different modes of approach. The religious approach is from feeling, so we can place religion in the heart area. And the scientific approach is by experiment. Where would we place that? Science is concerned to probe, to prove things. So we have to equate the scientific pursuit of knowledge by experiment with the male genital probe. So science goes down in the lower part of the tummy. Where do we place philosophy? Philosophy is concerned with the rationale of existence, the rationale of being, the rationale of relationships. It is concerned with ratio, and the place of that is in the head. So we have religion in the heart, and we have science on the male probing genital, and we have philosophy in the head as a rational pursuit. Now, for a long time, thousands and thousands of years, religion, that is heart relation, was the relation holding human beings together. They recognized in their common bipedal mode of walking about kindred spirits, and therefore religion preceded philosophy. But thinking about the ground of religion and trying to find the rationale of religion bred philosophy. But not everyone thinks as clearly as another fellow, and so there arose out of philosophy, through bad assessments producing skepticism, a movement towards science, so that we can say religion, philosophy and science, historically in that order. The religious behavior of very primitive groups, the binding together, religion means binding back into the primal unity. And then the attempt to justify rationally the religious rituals and procedures gave birth to philosophy, and then the errors of philosophy produced skepticism, which produced science. Today we have seen that history has resulted in the continued triple expression of human activities. There are still walking about on earth people who are religious. That is to say, they actually feel in their hearts that it would be very nice if we could all be friendly and relate together, quite independently of whether we are rational or scientific, whether we investigate matter or whether we investigate the realm of ideas. It is possible for us to feel oneness with each other, and this is the religious attitude. But there are also today philosophers who doubt the validity of this religious unity and try to find a rational ground for relating irrespective of feeling. And they do that by rational consideration of each other's purposes, and they try to adjust to each other's purposes by using their reason. But there are also another body of thinkers we call empirical scientists, and they don't trust the philosophers. And certainly they have no intention of accepting the dictates of a heart that says we are really all one kind of being. So these scientific thinkers probe everything. They probe the human brain with electrical methods. They stick little gold wires in your brain to see what makes you react to what kind of stimulus. And through this method they hope to arrive at some kind of consistent knowledge. Now, knowledge is made of particles of knowledge, particles of now-ledge, particles of experience in moments of time. And it is possible that a truth discovered scientifically in one period, in one place, could actually be quite false in another place, because it was derived in a now. It's a now-ledge. All scientific knowledge, therefore, does not add up to what is called wisdom. Wisdom is more than science. Science is particles of knowledge gathered together and categorized according to likeness and unlikeness. But that science does not constitute wisdom. You won't go to the university and say, please show me your scientist, the professor of physics, and then say, I have now met a wise man. He would say, I have studied and have certain elements of knowledge in a given field, in this case physics, but I do not claim to be what is called wise, but I do claim to be knowledgeable in my own field. Now this distinction between knowledge and wisdom is very important, and there is a tendency for some people to think that wisdom is nothing but the totality of knowledges. But it isn't so, because wisdom means the field of powerful sentience, the field of power that feels itself whole before it starts to search for knowledge. So wisdom is already a whole experience before it begins to investigate particularities of its activities. We know that the churches all over the world have been in difficulty, and particularly those based on Western Christianity, because the church became involved in political issues which were really not religious within the sense of the term. And as a result, people came to lose faith. At one time, God was believed in the Western world to be in charge of things. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. Such was the belief. And this belief was in the minds of certain types of imperialists who were doing very well when there was an empire to be proud of. That empire doesn't exist anymore. And in consequence, the idea that grew out of that empire also does not exist. There's a great loosening of the bonds that bound people together with a myth of imperial success. When the empire dissolves, the belief in the empire dissolves, and so we have people today looking for another kind of anchor other than the imperialist anchor. Now, when anything changes physically, the people who are focused on the physical are forced by nothing but their own identification to change their mind, to change their attitude as the form of the event, external event, changes. Let's consider this very carefully, because truths of one period, the truth of the Babylonian Empire, the truth of the Egyptian Empire, the truth of Greek supremacy at one time, the truth of the supremacy of Rome and so on, all those truths vanished as their physical representatives fell into dissolution. But behind all, there was a belief that somewhere there must be something that won't dissolve. And one of the earliest views of God was quite simply that God is the all, the Greek word pan, P-A-N, signifying all and signifying nature, once upon a time meant power in its fullness, and a power that felt itself, a living power, not an insensate mechanical power, a living power. And that power was called pan, the all, the whole, of whatever is. And that power pluralized itself, and invested itself in territories, in particular places. And it became, instead of one God, all power, it became many gods, each god being a special form of energy attached to a special place. So that you had a god of a fountain, a god of a mountain, a god of a tree, and so on, a god of a volcano. The pluralization of gods to the ancients meant simply that the one supreme god expressed himself differently in different terrains. This is a tremendously important concept, because it actually accounts for the differentiation of religions from the worship of one invisible all power to the worship of particular expressions of that power in particular localities, and then later in particular nations and particular empires and so on. Now today we see a double movement, a movement towards science, which you see exemplified in science fiction as the appetite of people for more and more knowledge, and simultaneously we find another one, often within touching distance of the same type of program in the world of radio and TV, the idea that there is a mysterious world, a hidden world that is not scientific and is not determinable by scientific measurements. This one appears in horror films and invading spirits from outer space and so on. But it is a real experience inside the human soul. It is as real as the scientific experience. When you do a scientific experiment in the laboratory and you put two separate chemicals together and they immediately explode, you have a delight in being able to cause something by a manipulation of material bodies in the chemical experiment. And that is one way of experimenting. But there is another way. And this way is intimately related to the religious way. It is the way that says, I don't have to put physical bodies together to do an experiment. I can put something totally different from physical bodies together. I can put minds together, and even higher, I can put wills together. This religious way of looking at the universe as a colossal energy of feeling, feeling its own relation with itself, is the basis of religion, it is the basis of magic, it is the basis of depth psychology. We feel, we search physically, and we think about what we feel when we search. Now there has been a representation of the All Power in different religious groups, major religions, with a clear distinction. In Judaism, the Old Testament as Christians call it, there is a God, but that God is intimately concerned with the human race and its development. And that God calls upon human beings to do things, to behave properly, to reform, as if human beings could do so. And Islam, in one of its sects, has said God's power is absolute and nothing whatever is done except by God. So that even if you bend your finger, it is really God bending it. The individual human being does not speak. God speaks through the individual human being. Now that is to take God in his absoluteness by first accepting the definition God is omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient. He has all power, he knows everything, and he's everywhere to apply his all-knowingness and his all power. In which case, a human being could easily accept that whatever he does, it is only God doing it, and he does not have to make any individual efforts. All is in the hands of God. But the Judaic position is that everyone is called upon by this same power to do something about their own condition. Everyone is called upon to do something about it. And then we have a Christian position where it says that men are called upon but cannot do it unless they get help. And this view focuses in the personality of Jesus of Nazareth, who is a type in history who appears to have been able to do things that other men of his day could not do, and who himself declared, "I have power to lay my life down and to take it up again." Now, we have been talking for a long time about a mode of thinking based on a very simple proposition that all energy is sentient. All energy feels itself. Now, energy is simply in working affirmation. There is sentience and it affirms work. And this work is a behavior of power. So we say, infinite sentient power is what is really meant by the God of all the major religions. Infinite sentient power. By means of the power, we explain all causation, because cause means a blow struck. So that wherever there is application of energy, we can talk about power. The word power means push man. Whenever there is pushing and things are being moved, whether boxes or masses of people, whenever there is change produced by effort, we can talk of power. And because this power exists throughout all space, we can look through telescopes and we can see stars exploding, new worlds coming into being, old worlds dying out. Everywhere we look, not only on Earth and in individual men and animals and plants, what we see is power at work. By power, therefore, we can explain all that science means by causation, behaviors of energy. Now, to rescue the situation from abstract science, we assert something else that we know also to be fact. We feel, we human beings feel, we sense, we have sentience. And we observe also that animals sense situations, respond to pleasure and painful stimuli. So that sentience is the peculiar property of that which appears in its other pole as power. And then power, the ability to push, and sentience, the ability to know that you're pushing, are a sufficient explanation of anything whatever. Now, if we take sentience and examine it, we find it means that you are feeling, but you are not feeling nothing, you are feeling something. And what you are feeling, in the case of your own physical body, what you are feeling is the resistance of power inside your body to the movement of other power inside your body. So the movement of your blood going through your arteries and veins is resisted by the walls of the arteries and veins, so that this resistance, in its being overcome, is your sentience. Sentience means that there is a movement, and that this movement is opposed, and that when the movement is opposed, then your condition is one of sentience, of feeling. And if there were no movement whatever, there could be no opposition to it, and you would then be non-sentient. You would not be aware that you existed. So it's in fact your very knowledge of whatever kind, and your wisdom of whatever kind, your very awareness of your existence depends upon the fact that power is moving and being resisted in the place of your organism. It is your organism that is a battle place of powers pressing through each other and resisting each other as they do so. If you put your fingers together like that and grip them tight and then press, you'll become aware that you've got flesh in certain places and knuckle bones in the other places. Your knowledge of your hand structure will increase as you resist yourself. Now let's consider this very carefully. When power moves to enclose itself, it makes an encapsulated zone. The walls of the encapsulation are nothing but rotating power, and the power inside is moving about, and the power outside is moving about. Remember our diagram, we have the circle, we have the letter R, A, outside, and then it starts to move. That movement is represented by the letter U, U, the English say U, a diphthong again. Other nations say oo, and it means drive. So the absolute, they are, drives oo to intersection, out. So that when you see that word A-U-T, out, you are seeing a name that means exactly a function in which the infinite absolute R is pushing itself. And because it is infinite, wherever it pushes through itself. It generates self-resistance, and it makes a letter T. One force crosses another force, and there is your letter T. If you then bind with a circle this out, you have an auto, the self. Yourself as autistic. Yourself as a being which is actually infinite power intending to make a zone for operation of an individual order. Every person with a skin surface is a bound area, an enclosure, in which work can be done differently from the work in another being sitting next to you on another chair with a similar skin and integument, binding that person and separating that person from another person. And when we look at this situation, we can say this, that in reply to the statement that God is infinite power, wisdom, action, presence, we are individually, within our skins, modalities of that power. That means that every single individual human being is a little God. Absolutely, there isn't anything other than God. And God means power in the Christian Trinity system, that is called the Father, and form, that is called the Son, and function, that is called the Holy Ghost. Now, whatever you analyze in any field whatever of universal being or behavior, you are forced to analyze in terms of power, form, function. A form is an encapsulation zone The encapsulation is made by power, and the power inside the encapsulation is working and doing things, and is therefore function. So that every being whatever is a trinity being of power, form, function. But exactly the same definition is used in theology to define God, that he is Father, Son, Holy Ghost, means he is power, form, function. So the only difference between the big God, or the infinitely large God, and the infinitely small God, and the mediating God, the little God man, is magnitude. That the infinite God simply has the same qualities that we find in any individual man, except extended beyond all limiting concepts. And in the same way, an individual human being is nothing but a precipitate of that infinite God. There is infinite power, there is infinite form, and there is infinite function. And these three together, which are not three separables, because they logically presuppose each other, these tend inwards, and when they tend inwards, they make an individual. And the particular individual they make that can talk about being so made is called a human being. The animals bark and snarl and bite and whistle and howl, but they don't write dictionaries. Whereas the human being does. And the human being is peculiarly bent to try to find out how he got here, what he's doing here, and what is his ultimate purpose. Now, any religion, especially the major religions, which have been beautifully formulated by innumerable councils, always comes back to this triplicity, that there is power, and this power has formulated itself, and then energized this formed self to function. So whether we take the Christian Trinity or the Hindu Trimurti or any other triplicity of powers in divinity, we find we're talking about the same facts. We normally do not, in our stage of history, think about the absolute as a triplicity in that way in everything we do. What we tend to do is, especially in the West, is extrovert our attention upon the material world, and then by manipulating the material world, we make the material world more comfortable. And it is the tendency to think that our real purpose is to make the world of matter a place fit for us to live in, according to our definitions. And that extroversion is a worthwhile thing to do, but that extroversion, and particularly the success attained through extroverted inquiry into nature, has diverted us and made us forget that there is a power which is infinite and which has itself intended and produced us, so that when a scientist is working to discover something, he is actually being driven by the infinite power, form, function, which theologians would call God or the Godhead. When we think about that very carefully, we'll see that it throws upon us a tremendous responsibility. You know, when people who believe in God but do not believe that they are little gods, they pray to God for salvation as if God were outside their own being somewhere. They would pray to God in the clouds, or they would pray to God in a non-space within the infinite, and they would expect results. And many of them, when they get no reply, begin to disbelieve in that God. And that's not a bad thing, because when they disbelieve in that God, they go into one of two phases: either negative misery, the world is senseless, or if that God that I have prayed to and who does not reply, does not exist, then it falls upon me to do something about it for myself. if I want to do something about it. And I can do that either separately, individually, with total disregard for other people, or I could do it cooperatively with other people. Let's think about that very carefully. Again, in terms of A-U-T. A-U-T. The A is the absolute, the U is the driving of the power of the absolute, and the T is the intersection of the power of the absolute driving through itself. And when two forces cross each other at the point of intersection, their interference causes rotation, and therefore in that rotation symbolized by the letter O, there comes to be a zone isolated from infinity as a sacred place of work. And we individually, each one of us, is such a sacred place of work. And the energy inside our bodies is exactly the same energy that is in the infinite God of all religionists, but intended and brought down into an encapsulated zone for the investigation of the possibilities of power under those limitations. Let us use the word form for the limitations imposed by power upon itself. Form is encapsulation, and encapsulation is impedance to free energy. The encapsulation is energy marking a zone by spinning in a spherical manner. Energy that is outside moving freely, called in Hindu systems Ananda, bliss, is going about where it lists, but when it comes to a closed zone, it hits against the zone, and the rotation speed of that zone acts like a skin, and the energy from outside bounces off and goes away to infinity, so that it does not work in an enclosed place like a man does, but it blissfully goes about wherever it feels like going. But inside this zone, the energy is trapped by the fact of rotation, and individuation occurs. Individuation is a natural result of encapsulation. The infinite power has closed itself, and in that moment has individuated, that is, divided a being from another being, and given to it an innerness. And then the rest of it, beyond that skin, is out to that inner. So when we write the word in, I-N, the I is a point of reference, and the N means negation and relative motion of intelligence for that individual. So that we say innerness, the fact of being an in kind of being, in a zone of encapsulation, means that we have, each of us individually, a work that cannot be done by anyone else. So to the very moment there is encapsulation, trapping of power within, there is the birth of absolute individual responsibility for what happens within that sphere. And those of you who have attended the philosophy class of Hanukkah have done a little bit about Heraclitus and his view of the world, where he used fire as the symbol. But fire meant energy. And that energy formulates itself. And you see in that Greek word from which we get our cooking dishes called pyrex, the pyre, fire, is also reason. That means to say that when the energy moves, it moves in curves and catches hold of itself. It encapsulates. It grasps at itself and makes beings. And each being is an energy, a fire, and an intelligence, a light. And light is a symbol of your intelligence, and your energy is symbolized in the heat, the fire of that being. So you have two aspects: a driving, fiery, desireful nature, and a being enlightened by the form with which you drive. When you drive, you do so in a particular way, a formal way. Everybody does things formally, slightly differently. I saw a few musicians last night, very young musicians, on the TV from various parts of the world, playing violin, playing piano and so on. Now, although they were bipeds and they had hands, when the hands went on their instruments, they went on in a unique way, and the judges had to allot to them first place, second place, third place, fourth place, for efficiency of performance, for sensitivity, for dynamics and so on. Actually, for space and time and power. Because when you're playing a violin, you put your fingers down on an unfretted keyboard in a certain position. And if you put it in that position, you will get a certain sound. And when you put that finger down, you have to put it down with a certain pressure. If you haven't got enough pressure, the string will vibrate loosely under your finger. And when you put the bow on the bow must rest on that string and get a certain amount of bite, and there must be a certain amount of power in it, and it must also be moved at a certain speed. There's almost space and time and power. That triplicity, which is the same as the other one, where space takes the position of form. Space is form. Power is itself power, self-consistent, the push ability, and function is the activity. Space, time and power, the function takes up time. So the same simplicity is there everywhere. Now how do we think when we are judging this fellow's brilliant and this fellow is not brilliant? This girl plays like a girl and that boy plays like a boy. In general, the girls don't have the same attack on their instrument that the boys do. The reason is simple, that for thousands and thousands, possibly millions of years, males have gone out hunting and fighting more than females have. So that men have, in their nervous organization, a tendency to strike, to attack. So that toujours attaque is a male slogan, whereas toujours wheedle is a female slogan. It is only through practice that these things have arisen. The difference between a man and a woman is that the man has behaved in certain attacking manners, certain articulative intentions, certain relational impositions, all of which are symbolized in the function and form and power of the male organ, whereas the females do exactly the opposite. They receive and they are grounded in ways to lead the opponent in to a situation rather than to attack a situation. And the very deep significance of this physiological fact is that the physiological members of male and female are not to be taken as signs of something beyond themselves, but rather that the beyond, the power, has acted in that way. In some occasions with aggressive intent and has thereby posited the form of the male, and in other cases has drawn, has made inroads into itself to invite victims in. And these two modes are in the power itself, which is called God. And therefore the Hebrew name for God, the Tetragrammaton, which is spelt with a yod and a he and a vav and a he, actually means he, she, male, female. Therefore it says that God made man in his own image, male and female. This power is a pushing power, but in the act of pushing through itself, it is also a receiving power of the push. So a thing that is so obviously native to human beings, the sexual function, is really a divine function at the physiological level. That means to say that the grossest material relationship is really the highest spiritual relationship possible, brought down into the level of concrete manifestation. Now, if this is so, we have no justification whatever for positing a duality in the universe in which the goodies and the baddies are forever separate. We have no justification whatever for a dualism in the absolute. There must be nothing but a multiplicity of expressions of a power which of itself is not multiple, except that the word multiple means many-folded. Many-folded. The power has folded itself and folded itself across itself. And when you look at these folds, you think you're looking at a plurality, but you're not. You're looking at something that is non-dual, non-plural, sentient power, which by its behavior and by nothing else creates the diversity of beings. And it has created them. Now that absolute power is absolute good. That is to say, whatever it does by its own will. And the differences that it sets up are a product of its absolute awareness of itself. So that whatever that power does is good. But it always does it immediately from inside itself. And that is why it is good. Because it develops like a plant from inside out. And then we come into a situation of encapsulation, and here we have the beginning of evil. Because as soon as we encapsulate, we can strike one against the other. And then, in that striking against each other, the relation called contingent, that is with touch relationship, in that striking, it is possible to knock another being off its course. This may be going that way, and this may come along and knock it out. And the one that had a purpose to get somewhere, being interfered with by another one, will define the interferer as bad. But both are empowered by this same absolute. And this has to be thoroughly realized, that in the world of human beings, through encapsulation identification, each individual man, if he forgets that he is actually the infinite self-precipitating where he is, instead of adjusting to another fellow's movement like a good car driver does when a lunatic comes down the road driving too fast on the wrong side of the road, you don't insist on your rights, do you? You drive in such a way as to avoid the collision. So in the same way, if you're thoroughly aware that all the energy that is operative in the world, in all individual human beings, all that energy is in no sense different other than in its mode of operation and identification in the encapsulated condition. You think that because you have skins separating you from other people, therefore you are individuals, therefore you have individual rights, and you tend to forget your individual responsibilities to steer clear of other people with their rights, and rather to insist. And it is this insistence on my individual right without my responsibility to collide with and push another being out of the way. Now in the process of this contingent stimulation, all would be very good in the evolution of consciousness, because you would find out things about yourself in the collision with other people if you remembered that you were doing it on purpose, that infinite power is actually precipitating all these beings and making them go about striking against each other to produce changes of form, of power, of function in each individual. And this process we call enlightenment. Salvation in all religions consists only in this. If you read all the major religions very carefully, you'll find they all talk about salvation, about release from illusion, from bondage, and so on. But the bondage they're talking about, and the illusion they talk about, is simply the bondage by identification to a finite, enclosed zone, to the forgetting of the infinite source of that same finite power. If you identify with your finitude, the limitation of your body, and do not forget that you are precipitated by the infinite, then you do not sin. But if you do forget that you are an infinite being and that other beings are also infinite, in the moment of your forgetting, you enter into a relation of collision, and instead of cooperative collision, with mutual enlightenment, you have resentment and a refusal to learn the lesson of the collision. Now, what do we mean by this? It doesn't matter how much religion you read, in any place whatever in the world, whether you're reading Hinduism or Buddhism, a revolt against corrupt forms of Hinduism, or Romanism or Protestantism, or Shinto, or Judaism, or Islam, whatever you are reading about the same God, because there is only one God, and that God is a triplicity of power, form, function. Sentient power forming itself and activating itself. And that is the God that is worshipped by everybody. And as soon as you begin to think carefully about what is worth worshipping, if you ask yourself, define it, what is really worth worshipping? Give me an offer, somebody. Tell me the thing that's most worth worshipping. Power. As a PT expert, Trevor knows that it's power, because he couldn't come in and do a forward somersault if he didn't have any. So most worth worshipping is power. And it is that power that is called in all religions the ultimate cause. And in Judaism it is God. In Islam it is God. In Christianity it is a peculiar thing, God incarnate. Because if Trevor were not incarnate, even if there were a lot of power, he couldn't make a body, if one didn't exist, do that forward somersault. So, something else is worth worshipping. What is it? Power first, and what next? Form. Yes, form. Because if we haven't got a form to put the power in, we cannot manifest. You see, the reason why God created, that is, well, that infinite power, created was simply because as infinite there was no manifestation. There was infinite power and it wasn't doing anything to show that it was infinite power. Sort of lurking in infinity. How would you like to lurk in infinity doing nothing when you're an omnipotent being? Would you like it? You couldn't say it was a waste of time, because there wouldn't be any time, would there? Because time is the serialization of that power. So we have power and we have form. And if we had power there and form there, would that be enough? What else do we need to worship? Function. We must have it that this power pushes this form about, enters into the form and distorts it, breathes in, makes it bigger, breathes out, makes it smaller, squeezes it, like a fish made of a double wedge can swim without effort because it's double wedge form. Go about with this power, push it through forms which it creates, and function in those forms, and bring forms together and make them into function. Now, so those are three worshipables. Now, we said sentient power in the first place because we know about those things. So, mysteriously, we have a trinity, but those three, power, form, function, are related. So there must be a fourth, and that fourth is the sentience itself. Because if there were power, and there were form, and there were function, but there were no awareness of it, of what use would that be? None at all. So we must have this sentience. So then we have the Masonic square of power, form, function, sentience, or awareness. It is not enough to be all-powerful, to be all-formed, to be all functional, if we don't know about it. Because the function and the form and the power have a purpose. And without sentience, that purpose cannot be fulfilled. Now, what is the purpose? I ask ladies, what is the purpose of power formally into functioning? Now, to put it in one word, it is joy. When you play about with the power and the form in a functional, interfunctional manner, you are really enjoying yourself. And remember that word joy. It's a lovely little short word and very powerful, because it means the affirmation of the situation to which you are sent. The affirmation of the situation to which you are sent. And when you get in a situation, if you want to enjoy it, you must, because you are in it, affirm that you are in it, and then examine it for power, for form, for function, and enjoy the relationship of the power, form, function. Now, how can you possibly not enjoy yourself if you are thoroughly aware that you are power, that you are self-forming and self-interfunctioning? Doesn't it follow that if you do those things, you must necessarily be enjoying yourself? Joy means the affirmation of the situation to which you are sent. So whenever you go into any situation, if you take on a new job, or if you give up a job and become a vagabond, or whatever you do, the essential thing of joy is that when you get into that situation, because you have got into it, and you have assented to being put in it or walking into it, then you affirm that you are in it. You don't flap about loosely. You actually get down to it and say, this is a situation, an encapsulation zone of power. And it is my duty, because it is a situation of power in which I find myself, to find the possibilities of power interfunction in this situation. So I must know how much power I've got. Psychologically, that means interest. How much form I've got. That means intellectual understanding. And how much function I've got, and that means postural manipulations. When you change your mode of action, you change from one posture to another, you are said to be functioning. And in each case, you are doing something. There is a little exercise done by certain religious groups called stop. And it consists of doing this. You go about doing your life, and you have a fellow who's dedicated to shouting stop every now and then. And he may do it at any moment, not prearranged, and you might be in the middle of doing this. And when the word stop comes, you have to get hold of the feeling of that posture. And you have to say, what does this posture mean? And then, okay, off you go again. And you say, oh, it was the wrong finger anyway, because my little finger is called the auricular finger. And if I put my index finger in there like that, I'm not using the best tool for the job. And when you meditate in the moment of stop about what you are doing, you become self-enlightened on condition that you know that you are a power doing what you are doing in order formally to function. This is a doctrine of divine uses, divine operationality, deliberately to do things in order to feel what it is like. Bend an arm, tense your muscle. See if you don't feel that when you tense your muscle, you're more aware that you have one now than before. Is it true? Now, Jesus said he came to teach people that they might have life and have it more abundantly. Now, people in sedentary occupations often forget that they've got legs. Some of them even have little devices whereby they press a button that shifts them from the office chair into the lift, into the car, and then out of the car into the home. That's an ideal, actually, for certain civilized people. But in the process, do they not become less and less aware that they are a being and fall into identification with a mechanical function? So, when you are doing anything whatever, on the word stop, you stop and you see what is the meaning of that posture to you. And in fact, because for millions of years we have been experimenting, that means to say this infinite power, wisdom, intelligence has been experimenting in this time process, we have done things over and over again in order to effect the attainment of a goal. If we point like that, we're indicating something with our index finger. And if we do that, if we just point the finger like that and then feel, what does it mean? We will feel it means I'm indicating something. Try it. Just point. It doesn't matter where. Can't you feel pointing intent in that finger? Now try it with your middle finger and see if it feels the same. I'm pointing to you. Has it got the same feeling? No, because it hasn't got the same form. If you look at the two fingers, they're quite different in form. The middle one is called impudicus, because it was used for toilet purposes long before those marvellous rolls that are so expensive today. Each finger's got a function, and this little one was for sticking in ears. Not for removing earwigs, but wax. And we've been doing these things for millions of years, and they have, through repetition, lapsed from consciousness so that we don't actually know what we've got. We don't actually have the solid awareness of our function, and therefore we can't enjoy what we don't know we've got. We have capacities for control. We can do things with our internal organs when we remember we've got them. We can actually increase or decrease peristalsis in the colon by going like this. We can alter our pulse by deliberately exciting ourselves or reducing it by making ourselves miserable. And we can actually do this. But through repetition over millions of years, we have become over-familiarized and forgotten our function. And we are dead in our sins, to use the theological expression. To die in our sins means in our separativities. If I forget that my head, my heart and my tummy are related together through my sentience, if I do not see myself in this square manner of a true Mason and say, well, I'm space, I'm time, I'm power, in every part of my being, then I am not living in that part of my being. If I do this in my finger, I increase my circulation, I remove more toxins from the cells and so on. If I do this on the piano and so on, I find that the more I do this, the more ability I have to do it. And by use of the organism and all its parts, I become aware of a most peculiar thing, that I am everywhere, through and through, power, sentience, formed function. And when I'm aware of that, in every part of my body, then I have a peculiar experience of warmth. Don't you feel this? And it is a true equality to say love equals warmth. As soon as you start doing something, you will only do it because you want to do it, because you like doing it, and when you do it, you raise your temperature in that place. Fellows that want to look like Mr. Universe do what they call muscle flooding, by putting the mind in one muscle, and they'll work on that muscle all day and not on the rest of the body, because they want the interest to make that muscle grow. And the next day they'll work on another muscle, and they work all over the body, round the clock and round the year, to build it up, until they've got them all well developed, and they keep flying with their imagination through the body, and they make the body live by interest. Now, interest is only directed sentience, and direction means form. And that sentience, when it is directed, mobilizes power. Where you are interested, the sentient power field of infinity is interested. As soon as you become interested in something, energy flows in from infinity to your being. And the amount of life you have inside you increases with your interest. If you're not interested, if you're indifferent, you are cold. Those of you who have tried to think in the morning, first thing, about serious matters will find that your brain doesn't work very well immediately. But after half an hour's exercise in thinking, your brain is said to warm up. Actually, it does warm up. And the passage of nervous impulses through those neurons is actually facilitated by raising the temperature. The raising of the temperature makes electronic jumping easier, and that makes connections more and more easy, and your thought process more fruitful because you are interested. Think about this very carefully, because it is a key to life. Sentience is our means whereby we know about power, form, function. So we have a quaternity there. It is expressed in the four letter name of God, in Yod, Hey, Vav, Hey, because the letter Hey occurs twice, and that letter, which is the fifth letter in English, the letter E, means the threefold life. The reason we write in E with three bars is because each bar refers to a level, the head, the heart, and the tongue. Letter E means threefold life, and there are two of those letters in that name of God. First, there is a dot, the Yod, which means a dot, or jot, or point of reference, and then there is Hey, a field of life around that. Because every time you have an idea, if you focus on that idea, immediately there begins to spin around it the power of life equals interest equals love. Love power, interest power, life power are synonyms. You get an idea, if you're interested, life flows around the idea. That's your Hey. And then you push that idea. That's the third letter of the Vav. And the third letter of the Vav is the sixth letter in English, F. And that letter, in its original form, was simply represented by the male genital organ as the supreme example of drive. So that the Yod there means an idea, the Hey around the Yod, the dot, surrounded by a field, is an idea surrounded by living, loving, life interest. And then the drive, the push to apply that idea requires another Hey, another life. The field of life around the idea was located around the idea. And it's an eternal, absolutely balanced field, because every idea is itself, in itself, eternally, utterly unchangeable. A triangle is a triangle, a square is a square, and a circle is a circle. Those are ideas equals forms. And around them is a zone of interest, and it is a standing field, rather like static electricity on a metal ball. A standing field. But when you drive, another field appears around the direction of the drive, and that field is the last letter of that name. The final Hey. It is said to be Hey in exile. Exile. Why? Because your island is your zone of encapsulation, and you could think inside yourself wonderful thoughts and keep perfectly still, and you'd have a standing field of interest around your idea. But if you try to apply it in the world and you start pushing the world about in the name of your idea, like Genghis Khan or Attila or anybody else of power, in pushing that idea you make a driving life that is not a standing field, and therefore is alienated from the threefold being, which is, in your ultimate analysis, God in you. Emmanuel, God with us, Emmanuel, means that God is in you doing the counting process for you. But when you start to act, when you push, is there not a tendency to identify with the action and forget what you are like in your utter wholeness in the field? When you allow yourself to think critical thoughts of someone in silence, and you contain yourself, not many people could say what you're up to, could they? So that your field is not alienated from you. But if you get angry through listening to your own criticism of that other person, and then you decide it's time to teach this person a lesson, and you launch yourself into action in the world, you have alienated the life force which is driving from the life force that was standing around the idea. That's okay if you remember that you're doing it. But usually, in the process of self-activation, in a moment of tremendous anger, and that anger is only God the Father, it's only power, that anger, which is usually called righteous, which is its formal justification, that anger rushes off and carries you with it, and with it goes the sentience that forgets that really it is an infinite power, and it becomes identified with this immediate present rage. And then you forget. And then when you fail, you become a standing field again. And you wish you had not made such a fool of yourself. But Blake says, if the fool persists in his folly, he will become wise. So there means from this something very important. Maybe I can get an idea, have my standing field and not forget my idea, not forget my standing field and push it, not forget my standing field and idea, and push the life force through the world and make a change and be Alexander the Great and knock everybody flat and then die at 30 something. I can do these things, providing I don't forget the four of them simultaneously. I am not alienated. I can do anything in that state if I do not mind paying the price. Everything costs something. Now, we've stated shortly the real meaning of all religions. We know we can get into trouble with sectarians very easily by contesting with any one of a number of groups. But we do also know historically that the formation of the groups generally and the split-offs in the groups have always resulted from some group seizing power finitely and abandoning this infinite relation of power with itself in the name of an oligarchical power of a minority group over another group or over a large mass of people. We know historically that the sects of religions have grown up in that way. When some men seized power in Islam at a certain period, they said, well, everything happens by God's permission and will, and we have won the battle, therefore God willed us to win it. So you have lost it, so he must have willed you to lose it, so do as we say, because we are nothing but instruments of God. That is one way of looking at it. The Spanish Inquisition did the same thing. We have found religious groups persecuting other religious groups. We find even within Christianity certain Christian sects persecuting other Christian sects. And we find certain people in Europe that have been practically wiped out for being the wrong kind of Christian by another group called the right kind of Christian. And this has happened in every major religion. Which has only happened when an oligarchy has forgotten this infinite power in pressing itself through all individuals simultaneously. And it doesn't mean that because one group loses, and therefore God must have willed it to lose, that therefore that group is willed by God to stay down eternally. Rise or be forever fallen, says a rebellious angel. When you are fallen, it doesn't mean you have to stay down. It does mean that if you remember your source, that source is that infinite power, that infinite form, that infinite function. If you remember that you are a precipitant, you will develop a peculiar feeling called presence. Today, throughout the commercial world, they tend to talk about charisma and so on. Charisma means nothing other than presence in a person. A person is present to himself, so he's not worried about whether other people think he's present or not. He knows he is, because he feels inside himself he has power and he has clarity of idea and he can function and he knows he can. He's got the sentience to do it. When we consider this fundamental fact, does it not throw upon each one of us absolute responsibility? Not merely relative responsibility to each other about particular activities but an absolute responsibility, because this is the absolute which is coming down and positing itself in Trevor and making Trevor say, what is the most worshipful? Power. Who said so? God said so. Why did he say so? Because it is. Because without that power, we can't do anything. We can't form, we can't function. And without the function and the counter-function which makes the resistance, we could not be sentient. But it wasn't Trevor Smith, a terrestrially bound finite being, that thought that one up. When he focused inside his mind, he didn't focus on his education as a little child. He didn't focus on what his mother told him at her knee joints. He just felt inside himself, and something in him said power. And that which said in him power was quite simply power itself, the God within the Emmanuel. And so with any other function we've got, whatever we do, if we do it in full consciousness, prepared to pay the price, knowing that it is power, it is form, it is function, it is sentience, and affirming in joy, that is, affirming the situation in which we find ourselves, in the moment of that affirmation, the act is necessarily a perfect act. Now, supposing somebody goes to strike the note C on the piano, and as his arm goes through space like this, the piano removers rush in and take it away, and so he goes like that in midair. Has that impaired the perfection of his action? No, it hasn't. No. There is a situation, if he's intelligent, he says, well, the piano removers came in, but my action was perfect. If they hadn't moved the piano, you would have heard such a note. See? Isn't that so, Sheila? When you're feeling for a note, and sometimes a piece of cheese gets in the way. Doesn't it? Have you had a cheese cram in the middle of a C sharp? Yeah. Yes. And at that very moment, is your act imperfect? No. It's just that something has interfered with you. But you see, your intent of power, your idea, because you could hear that note, couldn't you? And your function was perfect. But the gross material situation was incapable of responding to your perfect act. So you have nothing to feel guilty about, really, do you? Yeah, there is, isn't there? You remember what happened to Chaliapin when he was doing a recording and he sang a lovely high note. And it was flat. And he said, re-record it. And he went for it, and this time he was going to be flat again. He went, ding. He actually knocked himself unconscious. Do you know why he did? Because he hadn't got enough concentration to overcome the cramp in the throat. And it was possible that he might have done that. And that's a sort of super-presence. But if your intent is correct, and suddenly there's a volcanic eruption and you all get blown away, you are evaluated on your intent, your power, your form, your function, your sentience. You are not evaluated on the fact that at the very moment you're about to emit that beautiful top D, there's a volcanic eruption. God doesn't say, well, that was a rotten note because the volcano erupted. That power in you says, no, it's a jolly good note. And the volcano ruined not the note, because that was inside me. It ruined the external manifestation of the note, so that other people didn't get the benefit of my internal perfection. Now, if you apply that in human relationships, how often do you try to make a relationship with a perfect intent and something happens? You're about to kiss your husband good morning, and unfortunately, through romantic training, you close your eyes, and at that precise moment, your favourite pup jumps up and you kiss the pup by mistake. But your intent was okay, wasn't it? So you are going to be evaluated on these facts. Your sentience tells you about your power, And the amount of power you've got is the amount of interest that you have accumulated through continuous repositings of interest equals life, love. Life and love are the same. And you develop your being through interest, through sentience, feeling the power, forming the power, and then functioning through the formed power. How do we feel if we think about this as an actual reality? We all know that it's true, that we have a certain amount of energy to do something with, and we know that we can do various things with it. And when we do those things, we know whether at that precise moment we were doing what we intended and exactly as we intended it. And if we do formulate that power, which we are, in full sentient awareness that we are, and our form is accurately defined, and then we put that power into that function, that is enough. And it would not matter at that moment if we were shot dead. We would go into the next phase of being, which is just more subtle than the gross body, without a stain on our character. And in this world, every accident, that is a contingency, that comes to us by external pressures, acting upon our perfect intent, is no sin. If we think about this carefully, we are all inheritors of millions of ancestors who have had experiences over millions of years. And these experiences have been engrammed in the body, they have left their records there, and they have produced tendencies, instinctive, impulsive behavior tendencies, which are, from the point of view of our gathered together sentience, power, form, function, from that point of view, they are alien, they are external, they are memories of ancestral behaviors. Now, we are not called to account for the errors of our ancestors. We can only be called to account if, in full consciousness, we agree with their behavior. If we have a perfect intent in our own being to behave, to relate in a certain way, in full realization that we are power, that we are sentience, that we are formed, that is, we have ideas, that we are functioned, self-activating, then when we do that, we have a perfect act. And that perfect act, if we know that the other person to whom we are relating has the same perfect fourfold intention, it doesn't matter if something goes wrong at the gross physical level with the relationship, because that would be a contingent external alienated power from outside. And immediately, if two persons with the perfect fourfold function relate, and at the moment of relating there's an earthquake, so they don't coincide exactly, nevertheless, there is no question there of forgiveness or of condemnation, because you don't condemn another person for an earthquake interrupting your performance. You practice immediately a state of understanding that your perfect intention, that pure fact intention, that pure logical form intention, was fully powered with full interest. That full interest meant you loved what you were doing. And that powered the form, and the powered form is the function called life. And your sentience makes you know of it. Now, there can be no condemnation of other people's erroneous activities if you know that when you're trying to relate to a person with perfect intention, that they have an ancestral problem which contingently interferes with the passage through the nervous system of an idea derived from long ago and improperly assimilated by the parents, so that a faulty action occurs at the gross material level. But if your intention is fourfold perfection, then automatically, that is self-movingly, you do not hold against a person with whom you're trying to relate that there is an error at the gross material level, because it is not intentional. And it is only your intention that counts in the final assessment of your relations with each other. Now, very shortly, there is, to explain all things scientifically, a concept of cause equals power, push, ability, energy. And that we know it requires the concept of sentience to be introduced. But this power has the property that when it pushes through its self-resistance, it becomes aware of itself. And then you understand why William Blake said opposition is true friendship. The resistances that power posits are simply to make power aware of itself, formally and functionally. Now that will do for the first little bit about how far we have come from a primary concept. Sentient power is all there is. Sentient power functions as the universe of beings.